Let's talk about services now. Services are important because a long time ago, like back in the 80s, and yeah, let's call it the 80s, like 83, right? The start of the GNU project. Open source empowers people, or free software as they termed it. Open source empowers people to own the stack, at least to some degree, right? Back in the 80s, no one really owned their stack. They were everyone was in the same in one of, you know, a couple of same boats, and those boats were proprietary operating systems. And that's just where everyone was. I mean, that's where we all were. Everyone had a proprietary operating system, which is weird to think about, right? Like, there were literally no options. If you wanted to use a computer, you were using someone else's code. And I would love to kind of, I don't know, somehow experience that knowing what I know now, which is not possible. But like, how, you know, like, first of all, I understand that it would have been complex to hack on an OS. You know, like there are so few people in the world at that time who understood what how it all fit together anyway, that it just wouldn't, you know, you couldn't go in and like just change your operating system yourself. So, you know, it's one of those, I think that even if there had been the concept of open source at that time, and I guess I'm saying if I'm talking about 83, there was this fledgling project called the GNU project. GNU's not Unix, where they were thinking we should make a system that we could modify and customize for our own purposes. And it took a long time to get anywhere near that. So anyway, that was a big deal. Open source started, and eventually we got to the point where we are, well, right now, where you can own basically your entire stack. And there might be like little exceptions and binary blobs and, well, what about that ROM chip there, and what about this thing here? I get that. We're not going to go down that path. That's taking it to the extreme. I'm going to say for functional everyday use, we own our stack on open source. You own the code, whether you look at the code or not, right? You own that code. If a maintainer decides to stop developing that code, doesn't matter. You still have a copy of it. You could do something with it. Maybe not yourself. Maybe you would have to hire someone to continue developing it or something. And then you'd have to, you know, you'd have to find that person and offer them amounts of money that would make them give up whatever they enjoy doing and work on your stupid project instead. It wouldn't be easy, but that's the thing, that it's possible, right? There's an out. You own your data, and you own the computer, the physical device that you're running all of this stuff on. And that's where we are right now. And that's a lot of independence given to each one of us. Like, that's a really big deal for people who are doing important things on computers. And by important things, I don't necessarily mean globally important. I mean your life. You have things that you care about. Some of those things are on a computer. You own it. You own the computer. You own the OS. You own the data. You own the applications that you're running, and so on. And that's good. That's great. That's really neat. And recently, and by recently, I mean, you know, like since 2010, so not recently, recently, but recent, more recent than 83, I guess. The concept of the internet as the computer, the network as the computer, the concept of the cloud has really kind of unsettled this concept that we've been living with for not very long. Certainly not since 83. What was Linux kernel was 92. So I guess some people have been living with this concept since 92, but I think a lot of people have not. I think a lot of us have not been with Linux for its entire lifespan. And so in many ways, it's, you know, like whenever you started with Linux, then you owned your own stack. And then not much later, people started talking about how the desktop was dead. The desktop was obsolete. Google was going to come out with an operating system that was just a web browser. Fat chance, right? Well, actually, they did, of course. I'm being sarcastic. A Chrome OS is that. This was a wildly inaccurate anti-prediction that I made. I was insistent at the time that Google was not going to come out with its own OS. I just thought that was a monumental task for QA alone. And then it turns out, of course, that they got around that. They just don't do QA. It's great. So anyway, the cloud has kind of shaken this to its core. You don't necessarily own the code that you're running. You don't own your data, and you don't own the computer that it's that all of that stuff is running on. So every time you any of us log into, I don't know, a proprietary or a third party, I'll say, email provider, nothing about that is running. We're not running that. That's on someone else's computer. They've technically got that data. They've got copies of the data if they want it. And we don't own the server that it's running on. Websites, we don't own that. Half a dozen web applications, web apps that you use every day probably don't own that. And so this was a major step back for open source in a way. And everyone, I mean, it's not surprising, and it hasn't snuck up on us. And we've been mitigating it. I feel like the open source community has responded to this as promptly, I think, as anyone could. But it's a reality now, right? I mean, okay, yeah, maybe the desktop isn't dead as I sit in front of my desktop recording this episode. Maybe that was a little bit hyperbolic for people to predict that we were all going to be using dumb terminals by now. But then again, maybe that was hyperbolic in the sense that it just hasn't happened yet. I mean, I do know people, and you probably know people, that they honestly don't use applications outside of their internet browser, or the ones that they do are the exceptions and not the rule. And I mean, I know people who do that so literally that I have been able to switch them to Linux, because the reality of it was that they weren't using things out of the browser. And it became clear that spending any more money on a computer with a proprietary OS just didn't make sense. It just made more sense for them to get any computer that they could. I would install Linux on it, and then they would run things in the browser like they were doing already. I mean, that's happened. Not once. It's happened to a couple of people that I know. I've been able to just get them onto Linux. I mean, I don't say that as if though it's some kind of success story, because I don't know that it is at this point, right? And that's the thing, right? At this point, if everyone's running everything on the network, on the cloud, then does it really matter what operating system they're using? I mean, what's the key component here anymore? Where they go to configure their sound input and output? Like, I mean, what interaction with the operating system does a normal person have if everything they do is on the cloud? Of course, I mean, in reality, I don't know personally anyone who literally just runs stuff on the cloud. Like, I don't know those people. I'm not saying they don't exist. I'm just saying in my life, there's always that exception. It's like 98% of activity in the browser. And then there's that one or two couple of applications that they need running on the OS. But it's pretty severe. It's a big split. And that is an environment that should be concerning to someone who values open source. But then again, why should it be concerning? I mean, yes, it's different, but let's be rational here. Let's look at it objectively. Different, maybe it's better. Maybe it's just different. Maybe it's a choice that you make. I could run this on the cloud, or I could run it locally. How do I feel personally today? I'll run it locally and keep my stuff off the cloud. I'll run it on the cloud because that's more convenient for me. And that's an important thing to keep in mind. For some people, the reality of not having to maintain a device is a huge benefit. The fact that they don't have to store their data and make sure that they're backing it up every day because they actually do care about it. Handing that control over to someone else is a value add to a lot of people. And that's really hard for someone like probably you, dear listener, and certainly me. We like to tinker. We like to maintain our computers. We like to optimize. We like to understand why it's not running as fast as it could, or we want to understand how to make it better, or change something, make it more convenient, script something, automate something. There are people out there who don't care about those things. And if you tell them, oh, the cloud's really dangerous because you don't own the application, you don't own your data, and you can't configure anything, most of those things are seen as benefits to some people. What? I don't have to own, I don't have to maintain the application. I never have to update anything ever again. That sounds like a dream. I don't have to worry about losing my files because I'm not an organized person and I just throw everything on my desktop and then delete everything off my desktop every 2 years because it gets so cluttered and then I wonder where all my stuff is. This is great. I can just keep it on the cloud and they'll just store it forever. Like all of these promises that may actually have a bunch of different caveats, or they may not, but all of those promises sometimes feel like features to a large number of people. So that's not always something that you can sort of argue against when you're saying, oh, the cloud isn't so good. There are problems with the cloud. Well, there might be, but to some people, those problems look really great. The AGPL, the Affero, the GNU public, general public license from GNU, Affero, has done a lot to protect people from sort of becoming dependent on a cloud service that they cannot then replicate themselves. The Affero, the AGPL, ensures that the code that you are experiencing on a web app is available to you. And so should you decide that whoever is running that web app has become unreliable, or maybe they're shutting down their site, or they're not updating fast enough for you, or whatever, or you're just not sure what kind of code is in that app and you want to see it, the AGPL ensures that you have access to that. And that's huge. That's a big deal. It's one part of the equation, right? And I'm saying that the equation that we need to really think about here is the source code, your data, and the hardware. So the AGPL solves the first, the source code. Source code availability is guaranteed by the AGPL. So that's a hugely important license right now. And certainly other licenses are great as well. Like if something's Apache licensed or MIT licensed, whatever. All of those that guarantee availability of source code, those are hugely important licenses. I'm singling out the AGPL because I have a preference for the AGPL, because it requires people who then develop that code to also contribute the changes back to sort of the original developer, which I think is an important social aspect to coding that apparently a lot of people don't care about so much anymore. So AGPL and other licenses that preserve or that ensure source code availability, I think is a big deal for moving to the cloud, if you are indeed moving to the cloud. And I think we're at the point right now where I think a lot of us, whether we think of ourselves as having moved to the cloud, I think a lot of us have moved to part of our workflows to the cloud. As I say that, I'm trying to calculate whether that's actually true. But I mean, I would be hard pressed. I mean, it's certainly at work, but I mean, that's not me. That's the company's stuff. You know, I'll put their company's data wherever they want me to put it. But for my stuff, if the cloud was not available, I guess email really is about it for me, to be perfectly honest. No, that's not true. There's some video gaming and tabletop gaming services that I use. Yeah. No. Okay. There we go. Yep. So yeah, there are, you know, most of us use publicly available services on the internet. And that's why I'm trying to use the term service, because service, by any definition, is a thing being run for the benefit of others or for use by others. And so obviously a service can be something that a cloud is running and making available to people. It could be something that you yourself are running and making available to your friends. It could be something that you're running at home and just making available just within your four walls. So it's a service. And many of us are using services. And the danger there is that we potentially do not have access to the code, to the data, and certainly to the platform itself. Now, of those three, I honestly believe that one of the most, maybe that's overstating it in this context. One of the most important things, I mean, there's only three to choose from. So one of the most important things is the data aspect. because the data is the thing that makes it unique. When you're using a service, the service is the service, and if you input something into it, then it will predictably spit something back out. But the unique things that we're using the service for, that's why it exists. That's why we're using it. That's the purpose of the interaction. And so if you have even an AGPL application running online on a server, and you've opened your firewall port so everyone can use that service, then yes, it's great that it's AGPL. It's great that people can grab the source code if they want it. But if they're feeding data into the service and they can't get the data sort of back out of it easily, I'm going to argue that the value of that web app to a lot of users, well, there wouldn't be as much value to that web app to a lot of users as something that's not openly licensed, but does provide easy access to data. Now, I don't know if the average person out there in the big wide world would agree with me or not, because I do feel kind of like a lot of people probably actually don't really think that far ahead. So that might seem, they might understand why that seems important, but would they give up a web app that they quite liked just because they don't have access to their own data? I can't see that happening. I mean, I don't know. Can you, what's the export process like for Facebook, for instance? Is there one? Can you go to like a screen in Facebook and click download all my stuff and get your, you know, 12 years of family photos and school photos and whatever other stuff people have put on Facebook? Can you get all the interactions, all the chat histories, like, you know, everything? Probably not. So I don't think the average person probably would give up their platform just because their data might not be truly theirs. Their data might go away if that service decided to shut down tomorrow. Now, as Twitter slowly falls apart, I do understand that a lot of people have gone into Twitter and exported all their data. Now, I don't know what that means. Does that mean all of the posts that they have put into Twitter? And then what do you do with that data once you have it? I don't know. So anyway, the data is important. I think it's probably one of the most important aspects of this. I don't know how many other people think that way, though. I think a lot of people just, I really think that a lot of people, if Facebook went away tomorrow, they'd be really disappointed, but I don't know how actually, I think a lot of people just, especially with digital stuff, unfortunately, I think a lot of people have been trained that easy come, easy go. Like, sometimes you just lose all your stuff. What? Start backing up? No. It's better to just live life unaware that tomorrow all of your bits could be zeroed. But that's not the way that open source should be building open source. The community shouldn't be building open source with that goal in mind, right? We're striving for something a little bit smarter than that. So I think with open source services, we want the availability of data, of code, source code, which is something that we can do through licensing, AGPL, MIT, Apache, whatever. And we want availability of data, which is important and sometimes really, I think, hard. Because like I said about the exporting, you know, Facebook and Twitter, like what do you export? What are you on an online service? And I guess it depends. And it's probably, you know, it's certainly something that varies from application to application. There's a tabletop game application that I use open source called Planar Ally, Planar, Planar Ally. And one of the things that it does is it sort of helps you draw the bounds of a board game, of a battle map for an RPG or an exploration map for an RPG. And so basically you're drawing an SVG in this web application that then becomes barriers to sight and movement for the players on the other side of the virtual table. So exporting data from that application would probably look like, really, just, can I please download the images that I've uploaded to provide the map and the SVG data that I've drawn to give the walls and doors and things like that substance. Now, interestingly, at the time of this recording, Planar Ally doesn't have that capability. So this is an interesting case in point. It's not actually what made me think of this discussion, but it's actually a really, really good example. And I'm loving Planar Ally, to be clear. I'm not criticizing it, but it is, you know, like if I'm going to spend hours and hours drawing maps and coming up with essentially, you know, no code, low code video game development in a way, surely I would want to be able to get that data in a format that I could then reuse. But then the question is, and it's on their roadmap, by the way. So Planar Ally is aware of this. It's in development. It's working on it. But interestingly, that brings up the point of, well, okay, sure, there's this application and there I'm putting data into it. I can't get my data out right now. But when I can get my data out, what's the format? What's the right format? It's tricky. And once again, like if it's for me, Klaatu, then maybe the right format is just any format, any open standard format. And then the assumption is if you want to reuse that somewhere else, then you do the conversion. But is there something better than that? Is there some other format that other web apps of that kind would be able to understand? I don't know. I haven't looked into it, to be honest. I'm not sure if there's a sort of a de facto standard for that sort of thing. So data, it's important. Access to the source code, really important. Access to the platform can be important because if you think about it, if the platform itself goes away, then all of the other things go away. And if you as a user have no control over that, then do you own anything at all, really? Especially, I mean, thinking about sort of backing up, like if you got your data on a website that you trust for use with some web service that you trust, and then overnight it goes away, when was the last time you did a backup of all your data? And that's a really, and how would you do that for all the different services that you use? If I'm using an email application there, I'm probably lucky because I'm checking email on my computer using POP3, downloading all the messages. So I'm performing the backup I guess functionally it's a backup. I guess even if it was like IMAP where I'm copying files locally, that would be the backup. So in that case, that's happening. RSS feeds, again, yeah, you're kind of like, assuming that the RSS feed delivers all of the content, you're sort of automatically backing a thing up by interacting with it from its central location on the cloud, which I realize that's not central, probably it's distributed and load balanced and scalable and all that other good stuff. But you know what I mean? Like there's a cloud. That's why we call it a cloud. So we can say that place right there. It's not really right there, but it's a big cloud. But what are you going to do? Like if you're using, yeah, Planar Ally for your gaming needs and Mastodon for your interactions with other people and Matrix for chatting and all these other services, realistically, how do you back that data up? There's not really an easy way to do that, right? There's no sense of making the cloud your data store origin and your local machine, the one that you're sitting at, to be the backup computer. I mean, I do think that email and RSS is pretty close. Like that's in the right ballpark because by interacting with it, you are also performing a backup. And the important distinction there potentially is, well, yeah, I think an important distinction there is that there's a client involved. There's a local client application that looks at just the data on the internet and pulls it down locally. That's an important thing to keep in mind. And it's why open services really, really need to be based on a protocol with lots of different potential clients, such that you are able to, as the user, choose, do I want to just run this in an ephemeral web browser where I never actually touch the data? Or do I want to install the client application that synchronizes with that online store constantly, the online storage constantly, so that I get all of that data locally? I imagine it would be there would be different questions or different answers depending on the service. Like Mastodon, goodness, no, I wouldn't want a backup of all of that stuff at all, at least not right now. Personally, I don't want that. But do I want that for Planar Ally or for my email? Yeah, that's exactly what I would want. So it would definitely depend, which is important to realize, but it's also an important thing to enable users to be able to choose. We shouldn't make the choice for our users, right? We shouldn't say, well, no one's going to want a backup of this. This is just stuff that's meant to just go online and never be seen again anyway. Well, for some people, maybe they want that, or maybe they're not using it in the anticipated way, you know, the way that you anticipated. So the code needs to be available, the data needs to be available, and there's still that question of the hardware, right? And Mastodon, for instance, solves this in sort of like the implied redundancy solution, I'll call it. In other words, it is assumed that there will be enough people desiring to run Mastodon instances to meet the demand of all the people who want to be on Mastodon. That's the assumption. And should the group of people willing to run Mastodon instances publicly, open for public registration, fail to meet the demand of the people who want to be on Mastodon, then there would be theoretically a problem. And I mean, I think in a way there kind of was for like a day or two, where so many people from Twitter were going to Mastodon that sort of people had to figure out, like, well, how many users can my instance withstand? How many people can I invite in before this becomes not maintainable for me? And there were questions and ideas popping up for a couple of days there where, you know, ideas like, well, maybe just big public institutions, you know, like publicly funded institutions, I don't know, libraries, museums, whatever else there is, should be running like Mastodon instances. And who knows? I mean, why not extend that to be email servers and so on? You know, start to redistribute the internet, essentially, and make these services available to people. Now, the opportunity for mismanagement and that sort of thing is definitely there. But then again, the opportunity for mismanagement is here as well, where just random people are spinning up an instance, maybe, and people join, and then maybe they decide never to update, or maybe they decide it's too much work after all, I'm going to shut it down with no warning. You know, who knows? Like, there's opportunity for bad sysadmin throughout, which again is why the open source solution is kind of important. Because if you're on an instance, you're backing up your data, ideally, maybe. Maybe you're using some kind of client that backs it up for you. Whatever, your configuration's backed up. You've got all that sorted, and then your instance goes away. Well, no worries, you can just spin up your own, in theory. Let's go take a coffee break, we'll come back, and we'll talk about that in theory part. I think I have 5 rather pointed solutions to the theory of not owning the hardware in a cloud-based world. All right, I've got coffee, and not only do I have coffee, but I have the much anticipated, at least by me, Sunshine Coffee. Sunshine Coffee is the name of the blend that I got from Flight Coffee. This is not a sponsored thing, by the way. I'm just talking about the coffee that I'm drinking. Sunshine, they bill it as, it tastes like strawberry, peach, and pavlova. Pavlova is a dessert that was invented by New Zealand and nobody else. Origins, Colombia, washed, something like that, I don't know. Sun's out, mug's out, and we've got the perfect drop to pour into your mug. Oh, I see. So it comes with this little trading card again. I don't know if these are actually trading cards, but they're little cards with all the information you could ever want about the coffee on them, and it's just the most charming thing I've ever seen. And the coffee's actually quite good. I don't know that it tastes like pavlova and peach. It's not flavored coffee, to be clear. It is just coffee that they're claiming has sort of like the bouquet of strawberry and peach and I guess pavlova. I don't know what, I forget. I did have a pavlova once. I had a slice of pavlova or something. But I don't remember what it tasted like. But there is that sort of bright pop of kind of like a strawberry, like you can see what they're getting at. It's a fairly light roast, and it's got kind of got that, I don't know, I think of it as an open, not open source, just kind of, I don't know, an open sort of bright sort of aftertaste to it. And it is quite good. And it is actually quite noticeable as well. Or I should say it's noticeable right now because I'm only like 3 cups in. So I imagine, luckily I have the Unity coffee or whatever I got from the store as well. So I'm going to kind of alternate to try to keep the flavors fresh. But yeah, you know, the taste buds, they do acclimate to flavor after a while, I find, with coffee. So I do try to keep the taste buds guessing. Anyway, if you're in New Zealand and you have access to flight coffee, I guess, I do recommend the Sunshine Blend. And the significant thing here is that this is a summer blend. It is limited time. You can only get this coffee, I don't know, during the summer, I guess. So it's quite good. I'm enjoying it. And I finally got it in, which was very exciting. Okay, so let's talk about some ideas around what we could do if we're all really, really starting to use services online that we don't own the hardware to, and possibly we don't own the, well, I'm going to assume that we own the source code. I'm assuming that we're talking about, at this point, we're talking about running open source software, just not on our local computer. It's on some other computer. And I'm going to assume that we're being disciplined enough in how we back up stuff that we feel confident that we own the data. And like I say, I don't think we're all out of the woods there yet. I really don't. I think open source users and developers need to really think about how that data is kept. Who has ownership of that data? I mean, I realize that in theory, the user has ownership of the data. I'm just acknowledging that some people don't want to have to think about how they own their own data. And we've done that for years and years and years now, like decades. People have lived without backups for a very, very long time. And they're not going to start backing up now just because you're telling them, hey, you own that data. You should keep track of it. So something needs to be sort of, that needs to be addressed, I guess. And I personally think, as I've said before the coffee break, I think the most obvious practical way to do it would be to make the cloud, to treat the cloud as the authoritative source of the data, which seems like a horrible idea. But what I'm saying is that we use client applications on the local side that essentially backs up your data without you having to think about it. And that might be a little bit backwards because look, if I have my vacation photo and I'm posting it up to PixelFed, and then I'm using a client application to browse PixelFed, and I'm backing up my photo back down locally, then I've got 2 copies of that image, and why would that be? But once again, maybe, I mean, it could just be like a next cloud synchronization type of thing. Here's my PixelFed directory. If I put a picture in there, it gets put over here onto the internet, and now I've got my data in both places, and I don't really have to think about it, because it's just there. And then if it appears on PixelFed because I posted it there through Nextcloud or from, you know, directly from my phone or whatever, then it's also going to get copied over to my computer because that's how it works. I don't know. Something like that. And yes, there could be overrides. People could turn those options off. But I feel like, I don't know, I would argue that you would want it to be opt out. Like by default, you're going to get backups of your data because you own that data and you own the application. But I mean, these are all just ideas anyway. So anyway, I've got five things to consider when thinking about using online services, like how to manage that, how to make that happen in a way that it sort of works for you, depending on a lot of different requirements. So one is that you could form a collective. Doesn't have to be an official thing with a governance and a bunch of elaborate contracts. I'm just saying, I mean, you know, you should have some kind of understanding, but a collective. And now me and Deep Geek and Lost in Bronx did this a long time ago. It's kind of, I don't know, I guess I don't know if Deep Geek and Lost in Bronx are actually, I think they still might have, it still might be ongoing with them. For me, I kind of dropped out because it just wasn't fitting my workflow anymore. But for a really long time, it was really, really great. We called it Cray, C-R-A-Y, after the famous supercomputer. And it was a server somewhere in the world. So we didn't actually own the hardware, but we rented the hardware between the three of us. So the price became relatively negligible. Deep Geek functionally was the sysadmin of the collective. I mean, I think I was supposed to have been doing some stuff, but I was working a low-paying job that overworked and underpaid, that sort of thing. So I didn't really get that much of a chance to play around with too much stuff. And Deep Geek was really good at it anyway, so why not? And we used services among, you know, the three of us. We installed what we needed. We ran what we needed. We had Gopher going and did we have email? I don't think we had email. Did we have email? Yeah, I think we did have email. Email and various things. I don't remember what else. But it was a web host because it was Light HTTP or Hiawatha. I forget which one. But yeah, there were some really great services being run on that little box wherever it was in the world. And we each were responsible for our own backups. You know, you had stuff on the collective cloud. Well, you backed up the stuff on the collective cloud. It was just, it was a tiny, you know, three-person collective with people with similar interests and similar online requirements. And it worked out really well. Now, things have gotten a little bit more complex potentially now because, you know, when I'm talking about services in this context, in my story, in my collective Cray story, I'm talking about really just headless services, things that run on a server that you interface with primarily through a terminal, or, you know, you upload something and then you look at it in a web browser, that sort of thing. We weren't running complex web applications. But that said, web applications are getting easier and easier to run these days. So I could still see forming a collective and saying that, you know, we'll each have access to Podman and run what we need as a container, or you know, we'll virtualize some a server for us or whatever, and run your own service on you know, like a full-blown web application. So I don't see, I mean, heck, I think I ran OwnCloud on there for a little while. So yeah, it's something that's within reach now. So that's option number one, is form a collective with some trusted friends. You know, come up with some kind of agreement. It doesn't have to be a written agreement, but it should be some kind of agreement so that everyone knows what to expect from the other person. Less is more, I think. Having low expectations is great. And that's what we tried to do with Cray. We tried to keep it light. Don't expect really anything from each other because we were all busy people. And we were just sort of online roommates for years, and it worked out really well. I imagine it could go poorly if you don't know who you're rooming with. Like that could be a potential problem. Although ideally it wouldn't be, because once again, you would be you'd all have access to sudo as needed, and you would be backing up your own stuff, your own configurations, your own applications. And if the platform ever goes away through negligence or because someone decides to take their Raspberry Pi and go home, that's okay. You've got all the access to the stuff that you need anyway. You don't care. Doesn't matter. Now, obviously, there are privacy concerns as well. You don't want to put private keys and other things on a server that you don't trust the other users of. So, you know, all of that would be something to take into consideration. You'd want probably an encrypted, you know, if you didn't know the people, encrypt everything and so on. But I'm just saying, a collective is an option. That is a real, real option. Two, sponsor an admin. This is, I mean, in a way, it's what we did with Cray, ultimately, because Deep Geek really graciously became the collective's sysadmin. He's very experienced at that sort of thing. And you know, he just, a lot of the stuff kind of fell on him to do, and he did it. So I guess in a way we did that, but really what I mean by sponsor an admin is find a collective that already exists essentially. And there aren't that many, but then again, there are some. There's SDF, that's Sierra Delta Foxtrot, or I guess you could also say something like Super Domain Fortress, which is a name that they used to throw around sometimes. So SDF.org probably. SDF is a public access Unix server. It runs NetBSD. It's not a small-time operation. It's quite big. There's a bunch of steps that you have to go through to sort of get membership. I mean, you can get a free account really easily, but it's an account that you have to keep logging into every so often or else it goes away, and you have limited access to different, you know, services that they offer. You can pay some odd amount of money for like a lifetime membership so that your account never goes away, essentially. And then you can pay more to get more and better access to more and better services. So you're sponsoring someone else to maintain the infrastructure that you possibly want to use. There's something else called nixnet.services. That's N-I-X-N-E-T, nixnet.services, or service maybe. And that's just a random guy that I met online. And he's running a really cool little, I guess, a collective of sorts. He does take donations, which if you're using his services, you might want to donate. Because again, I consider this sponsoring your sysadmin. You are sponsoring someone else to do the thing that you didn't want to do, which is run the applications. Had this been on your desktop, you'd have just downloaded the source code, compiled it, and run it. But it's not on your desktop, it's on someone else's machine. And so you're sponsoring them to download the source code, run it, and offer it to you. Of course, I mean, none of these services aren't, they're not, it's not fast food. You don't get to just tell the person, hey, I need this, make that happen, and so I can use it. You can certainly put in requests, and they'll see about running the service for you, but it isn't a guarantee. These are mostly, I hesitate to say hobbyists, because that makes it sound a little bit trivial. But, you know, they're independent people. They're running things themselves, and they will, you know, they're doing what they think is best for their system, and for their users, for that matter. So those are the two that I know about, SDF and Nixnet. There are certainly others out there, but those are the two that I've got personal experience with. Three, build your own cloud. You can do this. I've done a Hacker Public Radio episode about this. You can run, for instance, Kubernetes on a Raspberry Pi cluster and then start up containers. I mean, I've done that. It's happened. It's a reality. So you do have to have a bunch of Pis or, you know, some computers to create a cluster. Three is really the minimum, and that's why I say Pis kind of make the most sense for that. Although, you know, Pis are Pis, so maybe you want something a little bit more powerful. It doesn't even have to be Kubernetes. You could just run the container. You can just take a computer, spare computer, install Linux as usual, and then just use Podman or Docker to run a container. It's completely, you don't need the orchestration layer. Podman does a fine job of, it's not really orchestrating, but I mean, it's a fine little engine to run containers in. And there's no daemon to run. It's a daemonless runtime. It's quite nice, Podman, if you've not tried it. Docker, you know, if you know that, then you could use that as well. But Docker's a little bit more to set up than Podman. So Podman makes it really, really simple to just run applications that are in containers. And whether you love or hate the concept of containers, or, you know, running a little instance, an incomplete instance of Linux on your Linux box, maybe that doesn't appeal to you, but it's definitely something that the cloud is using right now to help the cloud continue to scale. And it's not a bad technology to get to know. And it can make sometimes running applications easier than running them otherwise. It's a different concept. It's a little bit more almost application centric. Of course, then you have to learn the ways to tie things together within Podman, and that's not always easy. So there are complications there, but it is also an option. I mean, the other option is to not mess around with containers at all, and again, grab a computer, install Linux on it, and just run the application that you want, the web app, whatever it is. If it's a Python app, if it's a PHP app, if it's a Node app, whatever it is, you run it on that computer just as you normally would. Now, realistically, I'm going to say, like, a lot of things right now are being delivered as containers, and so it's going to be easier to run it as a container than it is to install the Node app or the Python app and then run that server or whatever. So just take that into consideration. But either way, you can own the hardware, like literally own the hardware, poke a hole in your firewall, and suddenly you're delivering a web app to yourself or to a group of users if you want, and you own the whole stack again. The downside to that is that you're now back in charge, right? That's now you are running those applications. You're the bottleneck, as well as the, you know, you hold all the power, but if something goes wrong, you are also the person that you're going to have to blame, which can be painful sometimes. 4, Sandstorm.io. I've never run Sandstorm myself, but I know people who have, and they love it, and I am really intrigued by it, and I keep meaning to try it, and I have not yet gotten around to it, but I'm gonna remedy that very soon. But yeah, Sandstorm.io, if you go to Sandstorm.io, then it says it's a self-hostable web productivity suite. And in other words, it is a web app package manager. So it is a platform upon that you can self-host. It's sort of a control panel from which you can install applications, web applications. And I've seen people run all kinds of things on their Sandstorm instance that they themselves are hosting. So I guess in a way, this is a little bit of a hybrid. It's kind of, or maybe it's just another way of looking at the option of standing up your own server and running applications either as applications or as containers or however you want to do that. Sandstorm, you would ostensibly need to have the server, and then you would install Sandstorm on that server and run Sandstorm, and then you would use Sandstorm to run all of your different web apps. It's a really nice interface. I've done the demo, but I've not self-hosted it. And it is. It's what it says it is. It's a web app package manager, which, you know, I mean, the limitations of a package manager apply. If no one has packaged the thing that you want to run, then you'll have to sort of package that yourself. And is that any easier than just running it on your own server yourself? Is Sandstorm then worth it? Who knows? It's up to you. You would want to take a look at it, see what it offers. But it's a really nice little app. It's a really cool little control center. And in my mind, it's kind of the turnkey solution to running your own services. Like, it makes, you know, a lot of the big services really, really easy to run on your own, on your server. And just as with something like Nextcloud or WordPress, it's really quite flexible as to what your options are here. You can have a computer in your closet and run Sandstorm on it, or you could just rent some space on, you know, a virtual, what is it, VPS, virtual private slice or whatever they're called, virtual private server. From any given host. Again, now you're not owning your hardware, but you could rent a space and then just install Sandstorm there in a virtual, or, you know, in that environment, potentially. Depends on what your permissions are and so on, but there's flexibility here. And then once you've got Sandstorm, which is, you know, kind of the app, once you've got that installed, then you have access to all kinds of packages that exist for Sandstorm. So, you know, things like Etherpad, Rocket Chat, EtherCalc, Draw.io or Diagram.net, Wecan or Wecan, the Kanban board, DocuWiki, and so on. So, you know, all kinds of different applications that, as long as they're packaged for Sandstorm, it's one click install. It's really, really nice. And it feels a lot like, you know, the hosting options, or when you have a web hosting and they have the, what is it, Installatron, the one-click, you know, application installer, except you know how those often just have like really, really outdated old PHP bulletin boards, like, and that's the extent of what they offer. This offers a bunch more. Like, this has a lot of, like, you know, new stuff, like stuff that you might want to actually run and share with your friends and so on. So it's really a neat little platform, and you can package up your own applications for it as well. So it's not just an installatron. It is an open source platform, meaning that you can contribute to making it, this little app store, this little marketplace, even better. And then five, and finally, I guess, is just renting space somewhere and running the web applications and services that you want to run. And just keeping in mind that you don't own the hardware, you don't own the platform, you don't own maybe even the operating system running on that platform, depending on what it is. The cloud is such a sort of a, so many stacks are involved with clouds these days. I would try to find something running OpenStack and then have something open source running on an open stack, but you know, cost is a concern, and so who knows what's out there. So you can rent space on someone else's cloud and run your own services, keeping in mind that you don't own that platform. If it's a big cloud, you have some degree of certainty that it's going to be around for at least a good number of years, and so you back up your configs, you back up your data, and so on. And you treat it as your own platform, because mostly it is, at least, you know, 2/3 of it is your own platform. And that's an option as well. Why do we need any of these options? What are we really safeguarding against? Well, I think all of the old arguments still apply. You know, the stuff about security and privacy and the ability to partake in the thing that you are, you know, sort of improve what you are running and share what you are running, and all these other concepts are still applicable. That hasn't changed. I think my interest in this right now, at least, is primarily that if the world is going to continue to move towards the cloud, then open source needs to be ready for it. We need to be ready for it in the sense that people are going to need the ability to own the platform. We need to be able to own our data and our source code. Those three things, I mean, that I can think of off the top of my head. There are probably other issues to consider that I'm not thinking about. I don't know, infrastructure or protocols or APIs, all that stuff, you know, whatever. The things that I'm talking about, though, just off the top of my head, platform, source code for the app, and the data that you're putting into the app. Those are the three things that I'm thinking about. And I'm just thinking that open source needs to ensure, we as a community, we need to be sure that we are designing and sort of using our services with those things in mind. Because I think the hardest part of that equation is the physical component, the part that says, I want to own the actual box that it's running on. I think that's the hard part, because a lot of times you're not going to, either because you can't afford it, or because it just doesn't make sense for you, or because you just don't want to. You don't want to be the maintainer of that thing. Then you may be surrendering that component. And I mean, a lot of us are surrendering that component. We don't run our own email servers by and large. So that has gone away. Like that component is, we are fine writing that off. Is that good? Is there a better system? Could we have designed our way around that? Some kind of communication system where you didn't have to run a big email server that had every potential of being either compromised or spammed to death? I don't know. Maybe there probably is. There's probably something that we could have done differently there. Peer-to-peer, I mean, people have been trying to make more things peer-to-peer all the time. So there's probably a lot there that has sort of still gone sort of not unexplored, but hasn't quite gotten the amount of recognition that it deserves. So the platform is going to be the hard component. That's the tough one. Because I mean, and I think, to be fair, I think a lot of things do ultimately need a server somewhere. So peer-to-peer can probably only go so far. So at some point, that hardware component's probably going to be written off. But that source code, we have licenses for that. And then the data that you should own, you do technically own, but how practical is it? How pragmatic is it for you to say that, yes, I own that data because oh, here's a backup copy of it that I haven't even had to maintain myself. It just has been happening for me, that sort of thing. So I think that's an important component as well. And sort of like ensuring that we're not getting into too much of a centralized model where we, you know, all of the things go to one place and then we're just counting on that one place existing until we get fair warning that it's not going to exist, and then we can all scramble to get our stuff out of it. But that assumes that we get fair warning and so on. So I think some design choices that we need to make and really thinking about what we're willing to use and ultimately what we're willing to lose, I think is an important thing for the open source community to ponder. And since we individually are not a community, we are just individuals, I think ultimately it comes down to sort of our own choices, the choices that we make. What are we willing to use? What are we willing to not use? And I think there's a big spectrum there. And I mean, at least for me, I know in my life, it's a pretty broad range of what I'm willing to accept from online services, depending on what sort of segment of my life they're intended for. Certainly my actual personal everyday goings-ons isn't really on the cloud, but stuff that I do just for fun, that can be on the cloud. I don't care, because if that goes away, then that's okay. I just don't, that's not a source of fun for me anymore. That's gone. But somewhere else will come up and I'll have fun there instead. So that sort of thing doesn't really matter. So there's, yeah, different levels. I mean, certainly, and then for financial stuff, that's a completely different realm of concern. So I think we all have to think about that sort of thing. We all have to figure out our limits and our boundaries for that. And that's important. And I think the more that as an open source community, we recognize that and we bring it up to people and sort of maybe share with people some of those determining factors, I think that could be an actual service to people. I mean, I'm not saying you have to like talk to everyone at the grocery store about it. I'm just saying like some people don't think about computing this hard. And so if as an open source advocate or enthusiast, you are able to deliver maybe a different angle of something to someone, shed some light on something from a different perspective, that could be useful. I mean, maybe not. I don't know. It depends on who you're talking to, probably. But certainly some people, they just don't think about that sort of thing. To them, the internet is the internet. And it's just, hopefully nothing bad happens there. Sometimes telling people, hey, you can have different strategies for that. Like that's a moment of enlightenment for this, for some people. I mean, other people just don't listen. They don't care. And there's, you know, that's that. But some people just haven't ever thought about it that hard. And that the concept of having maybe a different email address for this purpose, or a different username for that purpose, or not entering their personal information into that website. Like all of that stuff is really, that's really great information. So I think as open source enthusiasts, I think it's significant. There's some knowledge there that I think a lot of us have that can benefit others. And I think if we're designing systems or software, then these are really important matters to keep in mind as well, especially the more and more people start looking into their internet browser for everyday purposes. I think the more that we can bring open source to that, the better. That's all I have to say about services and the cloud. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.